coming to you live like I do every night from the heart of your radio. I play a little sad and I play a lot of glad and a few old cheating songs.
Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show at FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Monday morning. 251-343-0106. Got a 4 or 5 texts I need to get to. I will do those. Get to those in due time. But joining us now on the line, always a pleasure to have our state auditor makes time for this program. This time while up in D.C., Andrew Cyril on the line here. Andrew, good morning. How are you?
Hey, Jeff. I'm doing well. I appreciate the opportunity to come on.
Hey, thank you for coming on, and especially on short notice. Let's kick it off here. You're up in D.C. They had a Club for Growth event up there. What's been the mood of this go-around?
I had a conference over the weekend with Club for Growth, as you mentioned. It's called their Foundation Fellowship Program. And Club for Growth accepts 50 people a year into their program. We've had other people in the state go through the program. Stephanie Smith with API was in this current class. Chairman John Wall went through the class a year ago. Phil Williams, radio host, Right Side Radio up in Huntsville, has gone through the program. It's really good. It's just an intensive free market capitalism, low government, less taxes, less regulation. But they throw on top of that some things that are very practical for politicians, like media training. They did mock interviews with, you know, TV. They did what's called a murder board, where they bring you in front of, it's just a series of rapid fire, hostile questions you have to be able to respond. So really good training for politicians. And thoroughly enjoyed the program.
Well, you get the sense, is it optimistic? Is it pessimism? Any vibe, any takeaway there?
You know what everyone's talking about in D.C. is the Alabama redistricting case. That's what I heard the whole weekend. That's all anybody wanted to ask me about was what's going to happen with the redistricting case. Like, I have any kind of inside information on that, you know. But all of America is watching us with such a slim majority. Thursday night we had kind of a welcome dinner, and there were 8 or 10 Freedom Caucus congressmen that came to the Club for Growth dinner. And that's what they were all asking me about, is how do you think that's going to play out? Because the truth is, I mean, if we lose that seat here in Alabama, that could be the deciding factor in whether or not we retain control of the House in 2024.
Well, we'll see how that, I guess we'll find out any day now how that's going to go. I mean, we're pushing the limit here. I thought it would be out, might be out today. I know how this 3-judge panel has trended in the past, but we won't belabor that point. Let's start here. Speaking of presidential politics, it's a tough run for Governor DeSantis, but are you still on the DeSantis train?
Still on DeSantis train. We've got another debate coming up. I think it's this Wednesday. I think he performed well at the last debate. You know, Trump didn't show up. Trump certainly has a sizable lead. But, you know, if you go back and look at who was ahead in 2004, you know, in 2008, some of the front runners in those races didn't even finish top five. So it's really too soon to say who's going to win the Republican nomination. Now, I will put a caveat in there. In those situations, we weren't talking about a previous president running with huge name ID and things like that. So I realize that the comparison is maybe not an exact comparison. But, you know, I can point you back to the U.S. Senate race just, you know, a year and a half ago in Alabama, where Mo Brooks had a 40 or 50 point lead over Katie Britt and ended up not winning the race. So I tend to just ignore the polling. I tune it out. Both times I've run for office, I've started polling in last and I've ended up winning the race. So the whole point of a campaign is to educate the public on what makes you the best candidate. And if you do a good job with fundraising, which I think DeSantis has, he's come out the gate with very strong fundraising numbers. If you do a good job of messaging, then you can overcome all of that. They recently named a DeSantis chairperson for Alabama that ended up being Terry Latham, the former GOP chair. So they're starting to get organized in Alabama. And I'm still optimistic we may get a presidential debate here in Alabama. I understand there were some logistical concerns in getting the third debate here. So that went to Tampa. But we're very optimistic we may land the fourth debate.
Well, we'll see. That would be a feather in the cap. Well, what is? And then we'll move on to presidential politics. But I mean, the way I see DeSantis's path, if there is one, that if he can just get on a roll in these early states, and if he gets on a roll, then he's still in it. I mean, it's a delegate count race. It's not necessarily a popular vote or a percentage or a polling thing, right? that you got to be a little more micro-targeted than just big picture.
Correct. This race is different from almost all other political campaigns run in America because it's not an election day. It is a series of election days where you win delegates over a period of months. So it's really much more about momentum than it is what we're used to is, okay, coming up to election day, who's going to win? Well, we don't know. We just know who's going to win that particular state. And it's not even necessarily always about winning a particular state. It's about outperforming expectations. So, for instance, in 2016, Donald Trump and Ted Cruz were both expected to be first and second. We just kind of didn't know the order, how it was going to land in the Hawkeye caucus. Well, Marco Rubio was expected to finish fourth or fifth, and he finished third. And all the media talked about for the next 2 weeks was how Rubio had done better than expected. And he got so much coverage off that. I remember Ted Cruz joking about it that, hey, if I finish third in New Hampshire, I want the kind of coverage that Rubio got the last 2 weeks for finishing third in Iowa. So if you win or outperform expectations in two or three of the early states, momentum can entirely swing your way. The money can swing your way. So this race is far from over.
Joined by State Auditor Andrew Sorrell here on the program, joining us from Washington, D.C., well, near about Washington, D.C., Mount Vernon, I believe. But, Andrew, I guess the next question is the role of auditor. Last time we talked, it sounded like things are going really, really well. Things are moving in a positive direction. You're back in the Capitol there. It seems like the legislature really is supportive of what you're trying to do there. I assume that continues to be the case.
Relationships are very good with everyone from the governor on down to the legislative leaders. We've stayed in our lane. We've done a good job of just being the state auditor's office, staying up to date on our audits, not getting behind, even though we've been under budget for years. We were able to replace a part-time auditor with a full-time auditor, which is really going to help us. We used to run five full-time auditors. At the end of Jim Ziegler's term, we were down to two full-time and one part-time. So it's very difficult to keep up the same pace of audits with being that understaffed. But we did move back into the Capitol this past Wednesday. We hired a moving company and brought everything over from where we were subleasing from Ethics across the street. So, I'm pleased to say the Alabama Auditor's Office is back where it should be in the Alabama Capitol building. And looking forward to the next legislative session where I plan to have one or more bills prepared and ready to go, hopefully maybe even for pre-filing, that will help strengthen the auditor's office and restore some of the things that have been eroded away over the last few decades. And, of course, the big news out of the auditor's office approaching the new fiscal year here October 1st is when all of the new Board of Registrars members officially take office. And I've had to make some tough decisions. I promised the public I'd put people in there who were serious about election integrity, who showed up and did their job and who were skilled with computer programs that they used to redraw the lines with. And I had to rip off a few Band-Aids. There were a few counties in the state, more than a few, where I chose to replace our registrar. So I've had some angry phone calls come in the last couple of weeks, but I think I made the right decision. And I think that the public is going to be better served in those counties.
Now let's talk about this. And this controversy is probably going to come out in the near future, but you're a Republican, and as a guy who gets to appoint this board, do you believe in this orthodoxy that you're expected to put people who identify as Republicans on this board?
This is a great question. So we've had a problem in the past where sometimes Republicans get in office and I don't always appoint other Republicans. The Democrats never do this. If a Democrat is in office, you can guarantee that they're going to go in and they're going to clean house of every Republican that they possibly can. And let me note this, too. We're not talking about employees of the auditor's office. We're talking about political appointments. These appointments are political by nature, and you can use whatever criteria you want to determine who to put in them. So I like to find a highly qualified individual. But when I also say I want to put people in who are serious about election integrity, that tends to carve out a big segment of the populace that, in my mind, disqualifies them from being a registrar. If you are not worried about our voter rolls, Wes Allen just a couple weeks ago found 30,000 people on our voter rolls that had moved out of state and shouldn't be there. You know, those are the type of things I want to clean up in Alabama elections. I want people to be able to trust Alabama elections. People are fine if their guy loses the election as long as they know that it was done fairly. So I'm making every effort to put people who agree with me on election integrity into those positions.
does it matter, Republican or Democrat?
Well, I think it does matter because I don't think that most Democrats are concerned about election integrity. So, yeah, I think that it does matter.
Yeah, because, I mean, and we'll recall this, but, I mean, that's been the question, like, in some cases, and we've seen this throughout Alabama history, recent history, I would say, where you get in, Republicans get in a county and it's a all-Democrat county and all the qualified people are Democrats. It makes it very difficult to find a qualified Republican who cares about election integrity in some of these Democrat strongholds, I would assume.
It can be nearly impossible in some counties, but you just do the best you can. But what people have to realize is, I say, we need diversity with our registrar's appointments. And what I say is, well, in some of the Black Belt counties, the only diversity are the registrars. The only Republicans in the entire courthouse would have been put there by myself or Rick Pate or the governor who appoints the registrars. And that's an important counterbalance to the elections in those counties. So, no, I don't have any qualms at all about putting conservative Republicans into those positions.
Right. Well, and you know, should this be a rule? I mean, I guess while we're talking, before we get into the Algop stuff that happened last time, since we talked, should Republicans be required to appoint Republicans as a party practice?
In almost every situation, yes. And I actually authored a bylaws change. We got it through bylaws committee and we passed it. I think it was the February meeting where we passed this, that said that executive committees could not recommend for appointment someone who was not a Republican. We've had instances where Republican executive committees recommend to the governor, hey, please appoint so-and-so to circuit judge. And you go research so-and-so and you find out they're a Democrat and they've been voting in the last three Democrat primaries. I'm like, why are our Republican executive committees recommending these people? Well, if I don't want them recommended, then I also don't want them appointed. The problem is there are some counties where it is very, very challenging to find the right person. You get some of these small counties with a population of 12,000 people and, you know, 95% of them are one political persuasion. It can be nearly impossible. So I don't know that I'm in favor of a rule where it's an absolute, but I definitely think that the appointing authorities need to be looking at that, because I guarantee you our predecessors in statewide office that were Democrats, they were looking at it.
Well, it should have. I mean, like the governor, this was a Lindy Blanchard thing during the gubernatorial campaign, accused her, and I guess it's true, of appointing Democrats to some of these open judiciary or judicial seats. I mean, should it go that high up? Should somebody like the governor or the lieutenant governor or whoever with their appointments be required to appoint Republicans?
So you run into situations where in some of these Black Belt counties, if you were to appoint a Republican, that person is not going to be reelected. Now, personally, I would choose to still put a Republican in there, and I would say, hey, look, I mean, at least we'll have a Republican in that seat for a few years, right? But there was a person, I honestly don't remember the gentleman's name, but he's in Montgomery County. He was appointed by Robert Bentley as a Republican to fill a vacant judicial seat. This individual, as soon as he got appointed, he realized he couldn't win reelection as a Republican, and he just swapped parties to a Democrat. Now, ironically, this individual wants to turn around now and run statewide as a Republican, but he's going to be prohibited from doing that because my bylaws committee and the state executive committee have passed a rule now that says if you voted in a Democrat primary in the last 6 years, you cannot run on the Republican ticket. And that's an automatic disqualifier, except with 3/4 vote of the Republican Party's steering committee. So I do feel very strongly about this issue. I think it's very important that when we have an opportunity to put our people, I mean, let me use this as an example, Jeff. What if Donald Trump were to have appointed moderates to our Supreme Court, or even worse, Democrats? You know, would we have overturned Roe v. Wade? No, of course not. It's very important that Republicans appoint other Republicans.
And I guess the other problem with that would be, I think, gosh, it was maybe 20 years ago, Bob Riley appointed Juan Chastain to a county commission seat, and the Bush Justice Department came in and said, no, you can't do that. Now, Juan Chastain was an African-American gentleman, but they claimed that it was a violation of civil rights or something like that. I mean, is it just sometimes when you just, the governor's going to be forced, whoever the appointing authority is, maybe forced to by the federal government to appoint a Democrat?
There could be, and I'll be honest with you, I do not know. The governor has hundreds and hundreds of appointments to make, so this is a much bigger problem for the governor and her appointments director than it is for me in the state auditor's office or for Rick Payton, the ag commissioner's office, who the only thing that we appoint are basically registrars. So admittedly, I'm not familiar with all the different rules for appointing different positions and whatnot. What I would say is, if there is an opportunity where you have a qualified Republican to appoint and you have a qualified Democrat to appoint, you should pick the Republican 100% of the time. That's the way that I would phrase it. I think if you're having trouble finding someone, that's totally different than if there were three recommendations made, two of them Republicans, and somebody were to appoint a Democrat. That's the situation that I have a problem with. And that's the situation that I think members of the state executive committee want looked at.
One more question we'll get you out of here. We haven't talked, I don't think, since the summer meeting, but you got that rule change on who could take contributions from the AEA. Now, it doesn't apply to the legislature, but it does apply to things that are directly tied to education. I mean, is this what's been the reaction? How do you feel about it at this, now that we've had some time for things to kind of settle down?
I think it would have actually passed with a higher percentage. We got 68% on that standing rule change, by the way, but it would have passed with an even higher percentage if we had just applied it to all Republicans across the board. Because mostly what I heard after that meeting was, I voted against it because it wasn't strict enough. We shouldn't have our legislature taking contributions from AEA. Now, you were there, Jeff. You saw myself and Chairman Wall, who was the sponsor of the standing rule change. We argued against that because, number one, it's not a time-sensitive concern. Legislature's not on the ballot again until 2026. What was on the ballot is a host of school board, state school board, and superintendent's races. Those are on the ballot. That's what we needed to deal with at that particular meeting. But secondarily, I don't think it necessarily needs to be applied to the legislature right now, because I think the legislature's in the mood to pass school choice. And I know the governor's in the mood, because she came out 2 months ago and said not only are we going to pass school choice, but it's going to be the strongest school choice bill in the nation. So right now, I'm not in favor of expanding the rule. I'm very comfortable with it where it's at. I think it sent a message. I know it sent a message to AEA. Can't tell you how I know, but just trust me. The AEA has received the message, and they are very, very nervous that that standing rule could be expanded in the future. Because in Alabama, if they took the entire $2 million that they donated to Republican legislators and donated that money to Democrats instead, I don't think it would change more than one or two races in the entire state. And I think AEA knows that too. So, you know, in 2010, when the Republicans took over the legislature, they prohibited the automatic contributions to AEA out of employees' paychecks. And that really hurt the AEA, hurt their fundraising, hurt their influence in the state. Unfortunately, AEA has not really changed their stripes. I mean, they fund Republicans now. That's just because the Republicans are the ones in power. When you have examples of David Cole and Philip Rigsby, who are two state legislative races that we didn't know which way they were going to go, do you know who the AEA funded? The Democrats. In both of those instances, AEA chose to fund the Democrat, not the Republican. So it kind of gives you some idea of where the AEA's loyalties actually lie. My guess is the AEA will back off from opposing school choice. You won't see any more emails of them bragging about how they defeated school choice in this legislative session.
Right.
And we won't have to do anything else. We won't have to take this any further.
Andrew, we got to leave it there. You're very kind to take time out of your trip to talk to us, and let's talk again soon.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
All right. That was Andrew Sorrell, our state auditor, also very active in Republican Party politics. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Paul Show on FM Talk 106.5. Oh.